905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
Alrighty, that was Eric Carmen, of course, Never Gonna Fall in Love Again from 1975. Today, joining me right now for our live rendition of Consider This is Rob Washburn. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Dave. Good to be here.
And we have a guest who's going to be calling in just a couple of moments, I assume. And we're going to be talking to her from the Sexual Assault Center. She's in Peterborough, right?
She's in Peterborough at the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. And her name is Sonia Veliga. And she is the executive director up there, and she's going to be talking to us about the Gomeshi trial.
Exactly. Well, she is on the line. Welcome to the line. It's Sonia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very, very glad to have you in here. Now, this is something, I mean, Rob and I have talked about this issue off and on now since the Gomeshi thing sort of blew up. And, of course, the trial's gone by now. And can we talk about the impact that trial has had on perhaps victims reporting or not reporting this crime?
It'd be really good, though, before we get going too far, Dave, is maybe we should talk a little bit about what is her job and what does she do in the community?
Sure. Thanks. This is Rob. Sonia Veliga, I'm the executive director at the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. And our center is the physical office is in Peterborough, and we also provide some service in Northumberland, City of Kawartha Lakes, and Haliburton. We operate a 24-hour crisis support line that is available to all four counties, and we also work in the three counties, so Northumberland with the Violence Against Women sector, so Northumberland, Cornerstone, and other services that work in the field of violence against women.
Now, you work with women who have been sexually assaulted, is that correct?
That is, yes.
How many women do you help every year?
Oh, how many women do we help every year? Now, I didn't bring those stats with me, but we answer about... we answer about 300 crisis support calls a year from across the four counties. We provide some group services to about 40 to 60 women every year, and we offer individual counseling to about 60 to 80 women every year.
Wow, and that is that is. It may not sound like a large number, but you know, oftentimes it's not just the woman, right?
Our center does provide some service for men, and typically it's men who have experienced sexual abuse as a child.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what I meant by that was because, of course, we're talking about sexual assault, but also violence against women as well. That doesn't just affect the women. It also affects their children, too, right?
Absolutely. It affects their whole family system. Mm-hmm. It affects their housing situation. It affects their family dynamics. It affects the kids who witness violence. And mm-hmm. Certainly there's a lot of literature to support that witnessing domestic violence is very damaging for young children.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, okay, because I have a friend in Toronto who is suffering terribly with PTSD. He grew up in a violent household. He's in his late 40s now, a really well-educated guy. He had a really good job in the financial sector, was working for Bell Canada for a while. I mean, this is a guy who's worked on Wall Street. He was witness to a physical assault on a street corner in Toronto, and it triggered this reaction to what had happened to him as a child and as a young person, and he's now just completely shut off. I mean,
right,
he's been traumatized.
Well, he's been re-traumatized, mm-hmm. right? Because the experience of his childhood impacted on him. There's a lot of new research around brain experience mm-hmm. and the memory of the trauma, how it's stored in our bodies and in our brains. And so that watching that altercation, as you said, then triggered him and his body, if you will, remembered the trauma.
Mm-hmm. And so again, this is, I'm going to get to the Gomeshi issue, but I mean, when we talk about this type of assault, you know, I mean, we know that sexual assault for the most part isn't a sexual offense. It is an offense that is about control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that is something that's going to leave one seriously scarred. That's probably a good word to use. But there's also an unwillingness to trust as well. That's sort of born from that, isn't it?
You certainly look at the world with a different set of lens mm-hmm. after you've been assaulted. When we look at sexual assault against women, there's a number of statistics, but generally the statistic that is used is 1 in 4 women have experienced sexual assault across their lifetime. Probably the biggest statistic that has stood out for me is that generally women who experience sexual assault, a high percentage know the individual. And that's a link back to the Gomeshi trial mm-hmm. in that this was an experience of sexual harm from an individual that they knew. It wasn't a stranger in the alley. It wasn't somebody in the back corner, it was somebody they knew, and that adds to the, using your words, the scarring of the experience as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
out of the 360 crisis calls that you deal with and the people that you counsel, how many of those actually go to trial?
Oh, how many actually go to trial? Very few cases go to trial. So we don't, when people call our crisis support line, we don't we just gather that stat, if you will, the mm-hmm. call.
Mm-hmm.
We don't gather the details of the call.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the Canadian statistics in terms of how often they go to trial, generally, this is mostly from Stats Can, 8% are reported to the police.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 8%, 34% are arrested or charged.
Now, is there any reason to believe that those numbers would be reflective or not reflective of our area?
They're very similar to our area.
Mm-hmm.
We did a study last year and looked at police data in both the city and county,
mm-hmm.
and certainly there was some data that was, there was not too many exceptions to the data from StatsCan or other data centers. In our area, what we found was the age group most at risk was young woman between 18 to 25 years of age.
Wow. Well, one of the things that came out of the Gomeshi case, because, I mean, there's this whole thing where it looked as though the defense was trying to, if you, to use the word, smear the witnesses, was this idea that, you know, a couple of these women were alleged to have been sexually assaulted, and then they continued to have contact with Gomeshi. They continued to send him emails. One woman continued to actually see him.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to the credibility, and should it have anything to do with the fact that this woman was sexually assaulted?
Well, should and would. It certainly had an impact in this trial, and we haven't heard the outcome yet. But when you use the word smeared, some journalists use the word whacking, which is just which has been described as an aggressive defense style.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of you know, the impact or what the general public might think, you know, this case goes to trial, and within the trial process, it's noted that there was contact afterwards, and people say, well, if there was contact afterwards, how could the assault have happened?
Mm-hmm.
And really, those are two different sides of the coin, if you will.
I concur.
And so the question at the trial was whether or not these individuals consented to being harmed.
Mm-hmm.
That was the question.
Is it unusual as a tactic in a trial? I mean, you must know how they are run locally. Is it unusual that this type of thing happens, or when you in our local courts, do you see this kind of thing going on as well?
I guess I would really answer that in saying there are very few Gomeshi-type trials out there.
Mm-hmm.
And if only 8% report to the police and only 34% of that 8% are arrested, and that means very few cases get to trial, for one, very few cases. Then in terms of the court situation itself, I'm not a lawyer, but there's a different role that's played by the defense lawyer and the prosecutor. And so the defense lawyer, their job is to challenge that credibility, whereas the Crown, their job is to lay out the facts as they know it.
So that those strategies that we were seeing being played out in the Gomeshi trial, those are strategies that are fairly typical in most courtrooms, is what you're telling me. Is that right?
Yeah, I would think so. There is certainly an expectation that victims are not raked over the coals, if you will. There's certainly an expectation that that not happen in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, this type of crime is the only type of crime where that individual's, who that individual is on trial.
Absolutely. Well, we're gonna take our first break of the hour, if you don't mind. You're listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. Joining me in the studio is Rob Washburn and our guest on the line. And we will be right back after this. So please, stick around. And welcome back to The Drive Time. I'm Dave Glover. In the studio with me, Rob Washburn, my co-host for Consider This Live. And on the line is Sonia Valenga. She's the executive director of the Kawartha Sexual Abuse Center. Sonia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, before we went to break, we were talking about the Gomeshi issue. But one of the things that came up, of course, was this whole idea that these women continue to see him afterwards. That is not an uncommon thing, though, is it? Especially if women, as we said earlier, are sexually assaulted by people they know, right?
You're right. It's not uncommon. And similar to domestic violence, many women continue to see the individual that has harmed them. I think you open this with a commentary around power and control. And so we don't know, or at least I don't know, what the quote-unquote professional relationship was like and whether there were any power and control dynamics there for the individuals. But, yeah, certainly it's not unusual. I think, you know, one question that could be asked is it usual for men to keep records of this contact so many years later?
That's an interesting point, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, because he was able to pull up these alleged messages that were received, and obviously they got them from his computer, right?
Right. So, you know, it is an interesting question. You know, one reporter noted that he had a letter that was 13 years old, and so a question would be why? Why hold on to that material?
Mm-hmm.
To what end?
As somebody who deals with people in this context, do you have any insight as to why people do that? Not necessarily Mr. Gomeshi, but why people who do these types of assaults do that kind of thing?
Oh, hold on to material?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've learned in the field is that often a sexual assault doesn't sort of drop out of the sky. There's a pattern of behavior, a pattern of grooming and engaging behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a pattern of behavior, then that suggests an intentionality. And so similarly, an intentionality on holding on to material, that's part of that pattern.
Right, sort of like a trophy, right?
Perhaps.
Now, obviously, this has really shined the spotlight on sexual assault, especially workplace sexual assault. But the overwhelming statistics show that women don't report these offenses. And can we talk to maybe your opinion as to why they're not reporting it? Are they not reporting it because of what happens to them when they get on the stand? Are they being talked out of it by the police? I mean, how are they not reporting these offenses?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why they might not report it, and in a study from 2004,
mm-hmm.
These stats: this is 64% said they felt shame and fear, 50% said they believed the police could do nothing about it, 44% said they were concerned about the attitudes of both the police and the courts,
mm-hmm.
and 33% said they were afraid they'd be assaulted again by the offender.
It's interesting you mention these things because Dave and I did an interview, I guess it was over a year ago, with the former director of Cornerstones. And one of the things that she mentioned was here in Northumberland, we don't have a rape kit at our local hospital.
Right.
And people have to be transported up to Peterborough to be tested. I mean, are these other barriers that cause people locally not to report these kinds of things?
Well, that's certainly one barrier. Transportation is always a barrier when you're talking about rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
The rape kit which hospitals would call a sexual assault evidence kit. They're specially trained nurses. And so the Peterborough Women's Health Center has two specially trained nurses in this area of sexual assault evidence kits.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it's a barrier. I'm not so certain that it's what prevents a woman from reporting. And I would say that you know, one message that we share at the center is don't think about whether or not you're going to go to the police. Think first about whether or not you're going to go to the hospital. And start with the hospital. Start with the nurses at the hospital. They're specially trained. They're connected to social work services. They understand the issue. They understand the process of court, because they're often called as witnesses,
mm-hmm.
having taken the evidence. So we would say to individuals who call the crisis support line, we would say start with the hospital. And then we would also, if somebody said, I can't get to the hospital, we would work closely with victim services, the shelter system, in helping that individual get to the hospital.
interesting you mention this, because one of the columns that I read during the trial was by Heather Malik in the Toronto Star, and she wrote a very, very scathing column describing all the things that sort of the expectations of the justice system in terms of the of how you behave, what you collect, the order in which things were to be done. And she made it sound very sterile, but at the same time, it really drove home the point of, you know, the human dimension of this, and yet the courts demand evidence in a certain way. They demand mm-hmm. that people are going to behave in a certain way that is going to be logical and make sense and do all these kinds of things. Can you describe, obviously through the types of counseling that you do, can you describe maybe what goes on inside of a woman's mind mm-hmm. when these things happen?
Well, we would probably first say that there's not a logical process when these things happen. And so we've got a system that is maybe methodical in their collection, set against a person who has been harmed, who's, if we look at some of the material around trauma and in our brain, we spoke earlier about the impact. There's the idea of fight, flight, and freeze, and that our brain is kind of firing off these signals, and we might freeze and not respond the way we logically would respond when we're not facing this. So kind of like a deer in the headlights, mm-hmm. and there's no real linear process to the experience, but when we investigate that experience, we tend to investigate in a linear fashion. So the investigative process doesn't really match up with the science of neurobiology. And we hear that in domestic violence cases as well. Our memories are not so linear. Mm-hmm. They tend to be sensory in nature. So the earlier example that you shared of your friend witnessing something mm-hmm. and having that sensory reaction and may not have been able to put into words what it was, but his body certainly knew what it was.
Right.
We're also hardwired for connection, and so we think, could this have really happened to me? I don't, you know, when you start to doubt yourself and you mm-hmm. start to look at yourself and your own reaction, and that's where that shame blame piece comes in. And yeah.
Well, there really is sort of mixed messaging here. I mean, at one point, you know, you thought, okay, well, you've just been sexually assaulted. Let's go through the legal checklist to ensure that we can, you know, if you're going to make a complaint, you can get a conviction. That's one thing. And then you get other messaging, like, you know, messages from even some justices who said to victims, well, you know, you should have just given in to avoid further injury to yourself, right? I mean, women are often told that, you know, oh, just if you're being sexually assaulted, just give in, otherwise he'll hurt you more. But I mean, by giving in, are they not then sort of tacitly consenting? And at that point, can their defense not be, well, at first she said no, but then she said yes, right?
Yeah, I might not use those same words mm-hmm. That you're using, but when we look at the differences between how men behave and how women behave, women have over centuries been taught to behave in a certain way, mm-hmm. And part of that way is trying to navigate the conflict without raising more conflict.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's possible that somebody would behaviorally do something that a justice system might think is out of sync with an attack.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever counseled anyone that has gone through a trial? And can you help us understand what happens afterwards? Yeah.
I can't share any
Not specific.
I'm just general.
Yeah. Well, generally, you know, the in the Gomeshi trial, actually the woman in that trial had their own lawyer. That is not typical in a sexual assault trial where they have their own lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
There are some court systems. We had some experience with a Brampton court system, and they have a court-appointed dog who offers comfort and kind of helps de-stress the environment. Most court systems have a court worker that doesn't speak for the Crown, but helps the victim understand what might happen next and what they could expect next, without being able to predict what the defense lawyer is going to do. So they're there to offer support to the individual. And then certainly some individuals choose to apply for criminal injuries. And while that's not a court process, it is somewhat of a legal process that they might go through.
Okay, so as you said, most women can't afford their own lawyers, so they have
Correct.
To rely on the Crown, sort of being their corner man, if you will. But the Crown's only real objection is to get a conviction, right?
Well, and the Crown is not representing the victim. The Crown is representing the province,
right?
Right, and so I'm just reading a. Quote from somebody here from an article in the Rabble, but he really said, the Crown's job is to lay out the facts of the case plainly and without prejudice,
mm-hmm.
and they can't coach a witness or prepare them for cross-examination the same way a defense attorney can.
Well, actually, that was one of the complaints lodged, if you will, by Gomeshi's lawyer, was that these witnesses had been coached. So, I mean, that kind of goes to the point you were making there where, you know, the defense can take their case and they can sort of...
They can coach.
They can coach and they
right.
can create their own sort of version of what happened. But, you know, as you said, the Crown has to be very cold, very analytical, and,
mm-hmm.
and they can't... Because, I couldn't believe it when the defense for Gomeshi was saying, well, these women have obviously been in conversation with one another. Well, maybe they just experienced exactly the same thing.
And maybe, yeah, and absolutely. And, the getting to the trial didn't start from the day Lucy walked into the police station. It happened,
mm-hmm.
like, there was a history before the trial. There were more than three individuals
mm-hmm.
who accused Gomeshi, and, in some articles I'm reading up to 23 individuals who
right.
accused Gomeshi. So there was a history before the police got involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? And that's something my son said, too, because when the story first broke, I said to my son, did you hear about Gian Gomeshi? He goes, Dad, it's been all over the Internet for years. Everybody knows about Gomeshi. Everybody knows about Gomeshi. I'm surprised it actually cost him his job, my son said, because everybody knew.
Everybody knew. Well, I didn't know. So your son's smarter than...
Yeah, well, he lives in Toronto, so maybe he's
right.
traveling in similar circles as Mr. Gomeshi or not. But he said everybody knew about Gomeshi and his teddy bear and all his other weird things. And I thought, my goodness, how is that even possible that this guy is able to... But then you remember, you know, Uncle Billy there in the BBC, who
right.
for 35 years was basically a predator.
Right.
And they knew about it, and,
yeah.
and nobody did diddly. So...
Well, and so that goes back again to the power and control,
mm-hmm.
and that people, this person brought in money. Gomeshi brought in a lot of money for the
mm-hmm.
for CBC, and they were hesitant to do anything. And
mm-hmm.
and in fact, you know, at one point Gomeshi brought in a videotape, and I think that was the videotape was what management
yeah.
said. Oh my goodness, we have to end this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was as though they were trying their best to turn a blind eye. That's for darn
mm-hmm.
sure, you know. But again, you know, if people know, then you know the next question becomes: well, if women already know about this, how do they become victimized? And if they're willing to be victimized, are they in fact victims? Right.
If they're willing to be victimized, that's a curious phrase.
It is a curious
yeah.
phrase, but you know, it reminds me of what the judge said out west. But you know, sometimes sex hurts, right?
The judge said sometimes sex hurts.
Remember that? What was the justice's name out there?
Don't ask me that because I won't recall it right away. But he's the one that's under review.
Under review. And I get, you know, even going back to, you know, how are women taught how to behave? How are men taught how to behave? And some of what we're seeing in this past year, and really the Gomeshi trial kind of was the trigger for it, is to really say, is that what we expect of our men? Mm-hmm. Is that what we expect our woman to experience?
Well, that's a great question. And we're going to take our next break for the hour here. But that's the great question, because that's something Rob and I have talked about, is this complete lack of personal accountability. And when are people going to hold other people to account for their own behavior? So we'll talk about that question when we come back. You're listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. My guest on the line is Sonia Valenga. She is the executive director of the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. Rob Washburn, of course, joining me in studio. We will be right back, folks. And welcome back to The Drive Time. My guest on the line is Sonia Valenga. She's with the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. She's actually the executive director. And Rob Washburn, my usual co-host for Consider This Live. You're listening to The Drive Time, Canada's only holistic political chat on Northumberland 89.7. Now, the question just before the break was, what about personal accountability? And is it just that we're not instilling personal accountability in our men anymore?
Is it just that we're not instilling personal accountability in our men anymore? As in, is sexual assault a new phenomenon?
Well, it's not a new phenomenon, obviously, but it seems to me that, you know, the huge problem from my perspective anyway, and again, I'm not an expert in the field, is this idea that, you know, men can do whatever they want. You know, I remember our police chief a number of years ago, our former police chief, talking about boys will be boys when they were just making some vandalism. But, you know, we hear about, you know, sports teams, for instance, that get caught up in nefarious activities of a sexual nature. You know, and we had a conversation around rape culture before.
Right.
We've talked about this in colleges.
Yeah.
So what is it? Are we just not teaching men about personal responsibility? And is it just something that's not in their gene?
That's a big, big question. And I would say that we are not necessarily working with young men around their ideas of masculinity and healthy masculinity, and that the culture has shifted, but the work with young men hasn't necessarily followed that shift. So we sometimes do you know, work with colleges, and we talk about drug-facilitated sexual assaults, and the drug really is mostly alcohol. And there's this perception that that it's not a sexual assault if you rape a drunk person. And young men are surprised when we identify that as a sexual assault. And so there is a piece of learning there for young people. As a center, we've met with hockey teams, and you know, what they're telling us is that some of this is a culture. It's always been a culture of this is what you do when you're when you're a young man on a sports team. Like, you're the man on campus, and this is what you do. And there's some pressure from young man to young man to behave in a certain way. And there's also different ways of relating today that have young people confused. So there's the way of engaging is much more electronic today than it even was 3 years ago.
Well, we know, I mean, there was a local sports team here at one point that was caught up in an investigation that seemed to go the way of the buggy whip. There was the issue with the University of Ottawa hockey team, which they ended up getting suspended for the whole year because of certain behaviors. I mean, it's, you know, you made a really good point, because culturally, this is no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 70s, it was okay to slap your secretary on the butt. Well, it wasn't, but it was accepted in society. But there's been this shift where that's no longer acceptable. It's no longer acceptable to say inappropriate things sexually. So we, as a society, have said that. But your point is noted that we may have talked about it, but we've never actually had the conversation with our young men and maybe some of our sports franchises and stuff. Now, I know from my rearing, my childhood, that my father instilled in me a serious amount of respect, that, you know, no means no, that really ultimately a joining of two people is one that is consensual. And when I was being raised, if the girl didn't say yes, then it wasn't even a conversation worth entering. But that's right. How I was raised.
Right.
That's how I've raised my son. But, you know, I mean, he's told me himself, he's had conversations with friends of his and, you know, and they weren't raised that way. So,
So I guess my question is then, has the Gomeshi trial opened an opportunity for organizations like yours to get into a larger debate or into more public education within the community?
It has, and we think there's a fair ways to go yet. We have met with the Coburg hockey team. We've met with the Peterborough Petes and the Lindsay Muskies, and mm-hmm. and so that's some of the work that we're building and developing and having those conversations with young men. We've, in our recent study, people responded to survey questions, and they identified that the young people, that's the biggest, that's the first age group that they want us to address, and they mm-hmm. said young men, followed by young women, and then they also said, we want you to help parents have the conversation. And so many parents say, well, you know, we don't want all of this sex education in the school. It's our job at home. But our experience has been that people may say it's our job at home, but they're not necessarily having the conversations
so
at home.
So if you had a set of parents in front of you right now, what would you coach them to do, or how would you coach them?
If I had a set, it would depend on the age of the child that they're raising.
Mm-hmm.
But I would focus my conversation on equality and respect. I would focus my conversation on an exchange of words and rather than falling into something without having the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I would spend a bit of time kind of unpeeling the onion around how we look at boys differently from girls
mm-hmm.
and why that is. So it would be a bit of a conversation around those provocative questions. So one question I might ask is, so an example would be, we sometimes refer to white T-shirts with just the thin shoulder strap as wife beaters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask, what is the complimentary husband beater T-shirt look like?
Yeah, good point.
And then when you think about, okay, there isn't a complimentary, and why is that? And what does that say about how we think about young men and how we think about, so we think young men will be beating, and we think young women will be receiving beats.
Right. Well, that's a good point. To get to your conversation with the coaches, because I know this was something, and again, I'm doing my best to avoid mentioning any teams in particular, but, you know, because I got a number of calls from people saying, oh, you're beating up on the team. And I said, look, whether or not the sexual assault actually occurred, it's still incumbent upon the coaches of the team to remind the players, A, that it's not acceptable, no means no, it doesn't matter what the situation is, and B, as a hockey team that represents a community, you're community ambassadors. And mm-hmm. that it's your responsibility as a team that, so if maybe it wasn't your team, but maybe you're at a hockey tournament and some other team is doing that. It is your responsibility as a member of the Coburg hockey team or the Port Hope team or whatever team to say to those other team players, hey, that's not acceptable. We don't do that. That's not something that we're going to condone. And we're here to say, no, stop it. And Because really, until men start to step up to the plate and say, hey, this is unacceptable, mm-hmm. it's not going to change, right? So even if that hockey team wasn't involved in something that may have been nefarious or assault, it's still an obligation on the part of the coaching team to remind the players, okay, good, this didn't happen, but here's how easy something like this could happen, and it's your obligation as a team to ensure that you remember your ambassadors to the town that you represent, and that that behavior, if it's not acceptable in front of your parents, it certainly isn't acceptable behind closed doors.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I will say that the three teams that I did say, they all the coaches and management of those teams were interested in engaging with us mm-hmm. in the conversation and having the conversation with their young men. So there wasn't a pushback to us. They reached out, mm-hmm. And the OHL has as well. So I would say there is a vested interest in having those conversations, and we see that in other sports as well. Mm-hmm. The Argos have a huddle up intervention, if you will. It's a kind of a program that looks at gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. The BC Lions have a program. There are a number of universities that have a program. So there is some of that work is starting to happen, and certainly we see that in the States. There have been a few high-profile cases in the States. The thing about sports is there is such a focus on succeeding that it makes it difficult. Well, it doesn't make it difficult, but people have chosen perhaps not to say something because they don't want to cause somebody leaving the team.
Right. Has there been any aspect of the Gomeshi trial that has had a positive effect? I mean, we're having this conversation because of the trial, and that raises awareness, and I'm sure there are educational values. But beyond that, is there anything positive that's come out of this for organizations like yourself?
Mm-hmm. Probably the most positive is that everybody's talking about it. And then certainly the province has infused some monies into this whole area, and in particular they've done some public service announcements by means of commercials mm-hmm. that are really focused on young people. So if you have a chance, take a look at those commercials. I think the negative piece from this is that I would think that more people are going to, very few people want to go to court, mm-hmm. want to go to trial. And that number will probably increase.
Well, that's kind of my hope, because one of the things I'd like to see happen as a result of this, just because of the flagrant way in which these assaults occurred, I think it's time that there has to be some way we can encourage victims to come forward. I know there's a level of embarrassment that's involved. You know, I spoke to a woman who had been sexually assaulted in my early 20s, and I encouraged her to report it. And she said, well, I feel kind of guilty. I said, look, if someone walked into your bank and you were a teller and stuck a gun in your face, would you feel guilty? Would you feel like you couldn't report that crime because, you know, you
yes,
feel kind of guilty?
But nobody would ask that woman, that teller,
mm-hmm.
Why she was wearing that skirt, or whether or not she said hi to that client the next day,
mm-hmm.
or right? So within sexual assault trials, there's that much more of the individual that mm-hmm. comes into the court experience. We certainly are seeing women saying, you know, enough already. There are women can have their names withheld, and certainly there are more women who are saying, I don't need a publication ban. I haven't done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You may use my name, but it's a difficult process for a woman. I guess publicly would want to acknowledge that there are supports like the court support program that can sit with that woman in that courthouse. It is a difficult process.
Can people volunteer to work for you? Do you get volunteers coming in saying, okay, I want to help women that are in crisis.
Sure.
I want to help them through the court process. Is that something that's available to people?
Yep, it's absolutely available to people, and we have many volunteers who come through and many young people who come through from Fleming or Trent University who want to volunteer and be supportive. We're looking for young men to volunteer mm-hmm. to host some of those conversations with other young men as well. So our volunteers do a number of things, but certainly supporting somebody within the court system, that would be available to them.
One of the things that has also been talked about is reform in the courts. To finish up, what needs to take place to make it a different system, maybe a better system?
Oh, you've got me there. What needs to take place? I don't know if our justice system as a whole, a big whole, is like that. There's a fair bit of reformation, if you will, that would need to happen there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank in terms of what would need to happen in the court system itself as a system. Looking at that particular crime in isolation of all the rest.
Right. So there needs to be, because again, you know, in the U.S. they have rape. In Canada, we don't have rape. We have various degrees of sexual assault, right?
Right.
And maybe it needs to be referred to as that, you know? I spoke to a person, and this is really quickly, I mean, you know, when we talk about child pornography instance, right? Like, it's never referred to as child sexual assault. It's always referred to as child pornography or something.
We
not
use our words, don't we?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We need to have words that with impact. You know,
yeah.
If a
and
child
rape is certainly a political word.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And if people are being used, like for instance, if children are being used and they're saying, "Oh, well, then we busted up a child pornography ring." You know what? You busted up a child sexual assault ring is what you
mm-hmm.
broke up. Let's talk and let's tell it what it really is. Let's not paint it with pretty pictures, because rape, sexual assault, and violence against individuals is a terrible thing, and there's no reason why we should paint it with a pretty brush. It's not a pretty thing. It's something that needs to be ugly, and the terms we use need to be just as ugly, in my opinion.
They need to be strong, and,
mm-hmm.
and you're absolutely right.
Well, I want to thank you, Sonia, really for making this hour fly
thank
by,
so
but
much.
Also for helping us out and helping some of our listeners perhaps understand the role you play. Sonia Valenga is the executive director at the Kawartha Sexual Assault Center. They're located in Peterborough, but as she says, she works with the three counties and down here as well. Rob Washburn, my co-host, as always, I want to thank you for being here. Sonia, we'll talk to you again, I'm sure. Thank you
okay.
very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
Well, again, always a topic that needs to be addressed for whatever reason. It just never seems to go away. This is one of those topics that is perpetually there. And I don't know what it is, Rob. I don't know what's going to take to change that up for us. I really don't.
Well, I think conversations like this, you're right, are absolutely critical for us to get it out there and to be aware of what's happening. Incredible. 340 calls into that center every year from our region. So it's a problem in our community.
Well, and the stats say that's 34% of all cases. So if
yep.
that's all it takes, then we need to change those numbers, multiply them. Here is Alice Cooper with the most appropriate song I could find. Here is Only Women Bleed, a song about sexual assault and living with domestic violence. I'm Dave Glover. You're listening to The Drive Time. Thanks again for tuning in. And just a reminder, folks, we don't write the world. We just report it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Man got his woman. Take your seat. He got the power, oh, she got the need.